Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is the United States of Anxiety, a show about the unfinished business of our history and its grip on our future.
The implications, Brian, of course, are massive. This is sort of the biggest unionization effort that Amazon has ever seen on U.S. soil.
We need systemic change in how corporations behave in our economy and how Black people are treated throughout society.
We know that the most likely group of people that say that they would form and join a union tomorrow are people of color and women, for we have had no choice.
One struggle, one fight!
You can't suggest that they stand before an employer that really holds life and death, in a sense, over their livelihood.
Well, let's face it, the labor movement was a major institution propelling us toward equality.
The choice to join a union is up to the workers, full stop. Full stop.
Welcome to the show. I'm Kai Wright. I've been thinking about an encounter I had a couple of years ago. We were gearing up to cover the 2018 midterm elections on this show, and that summer, I went with one of our producers to the suburbs around Pittsburgh. There was a special election there, and everybody was watching it. It was considered an early indicator of what might happen in the congressional elections, which were, of course, themselves early indicators of what might happen in 2020. So it was an intense moment, politically at least, for this little suburb. Anyway, the Republican strategy was to make the race all about hating Nancy Pelosi. And we went out with canvassers who were knocking on doors and talking to voters because we wanted to hear what people had to say about Pelosi, about this powerful, often demonized woman. We were in this famously blue-collar area, a classic neighborhood of modest houses, home to the kind of workers that both parties have so often invoked as avatars of their political platforms. And we went door-to-door, stood on stoop after stoop, and then this one encounter really stuck with me. A woman answered the door, maybe in her upper middle ages. She was still in the workforce. Sounded like she had a big family kind of sprawled out around the area, all super busy with their own work grind. And this woman, she looked at us like we were crazy when we asked her about Nancy Pelosi. Instead, she started talking about time and missing her kids and her grandkids and how hard it was to just stay connected to them, to be a family. When asked what she wanted from her congresswoman, this woman said she wanted to reclaim her time, time to spend with her family. I'm thinking about this encounter this week because I'm also watching what may be the most notable political fight happening right now. Away from Congress, away from the White House, down in Bessemer, Alabama, where nearly 6,000 workers are voting this month on whether to create the first ever union at an Amazon facility in the United States. This one union drive carries so much subtext. For one, it's kind of become the latest battleground for the fight over political power in the South. It's drawn the attention of celebrities, athletes, Stacey Abrams. And last Sunday, Joe Biden posted a Twitter video that has been called the most pro-union statement by any modern president, and maybe any president ever.
I have long said America wasn't built by Wall Street. It was built by the middle class, and unions built the middle class. Unions put power in the hands of workers. They level the playing field. They give you a stronger voice for your health, your safety, higher wages, protection from racial discrimination and sexual harassment. Unions lift up workers, both union and non-union, and especially Black and brown workers.
This was a striking statement on so many levels. Democrats, going back to at least Jimmy Carter, have been far more fuzzy about their ties to labor. And Biden is actively embracing these workers in the middle of a high-profile union drive. Moreover, he's framed it in terms of racial justice and gender equity, which, frankly, hasn't always been true of unions. And while he didn't name Amazon, he did directly name the workers.
Today and over the next few days and weeks, workers in Alabama and all across America are voting on whether to organize a union in their workplace. This is vitally important, a vitally important choice as America grapples with the deadly pandemic, the economic crisis, and the reckoning on race, what it reveals, the deep disparities that still exist in our country.
Roughly 80% of the workers at Amazon's facility in Bessemer, Alabama, are Black. It's been reported that the majority of its warehouse workforce nationally are people of color. So this is a story about racial justice. It's also a story about Democratic Party politics and about the historical arc of social movements that have changed that party and have changed unions, for that matter. But also, there's still this deeper story about time. Our time and our humanity inside this modern economy. The kind of stuff that the woman I met in those suburbs of Pennsylvania was trying to tell me back in 2018. So to try to stitch together all of these complicated threads and better see what is really happening in this moment, I'm joined by labor journalist Sarah Jaffe. Hey, Sarah, thanks for coming on.
Hello.
Sarah's most recent book is just out. It's hot off the presses. If you go get it, it's called Work Won't Love You Back. And in it, she's poking at our cultural ideas about work and its value and how these ideas set us up for exploitation. She has also spent many years covering the labor movement specifically and social movements around economic justice generally. She's a fellow of the Type Media Center and a big-hearted reporter and who I figured could help me understand what's really happening in this moment. So, Sarah, let us start with Amazon itself. And the first thing that's kind of confusing about it is, you know, they're not even necessarily demanding higher pay. It's not a wages fight per se. Amazon already pays $15 an hour minimum wage, which is what the economic justice movements have been trying to establish nationally. So these workers are looking for something less transactional. I read one worker who said it's about being heard. What do you think this is really about?
I mean, I love the intro that you gave with the story about time, right? Because I think the real truth of the labor movement is it's about people trying to reclaim some autonomy over what they do with their time, which, as Selma James said, just happens to be our lives. And I think that's a really, really important point in a story like this, right? Where like, yeah, Amazon is a pretty, I mean, $15 an hour is still not that much money in most of America. But in this part of Alabama, it's not a bad wage. You know, these workers are probably making more than they would make in other places. But the stories of work in those Amazon warehouses are about much more than how much they're getting paid for it. It's about like being relentlessly tracked over how much time you spend off task. If you have to do something like go to the bathroom in a, you know, warehouse the size of multiple football fields, they're, you know, talk about just like the grind on your body of having to keep up with machines, and just the disrespect that you feel over and over again. And anybody who's ever worked, I mean, anybody who's ever worked, let me just put a period on that sentence, but I mean, anybody who's ever worked that kind of job where you're mostly doing manual labor has probably known what it's like for your employer, your manager, your sort of direct supervisor to basically, in so many words, tell you that you're replaceable, that you're expendable. And I think it's really notable in this case that this Amazon facility out in Bessemer, Alabama, outside of Birmingham, has only been open since last March. It's basically only been open in pandemic times. Right. And like, I think, again, nobody who's listening to this show who's still working, if you are idle rich or retired, I'm jealous. Because I think we all have had our experience of work get worse this year.
Yeah. Well, and how fast? I mean, I just want to underline when you say that it's only open since March. That's how quick this unionization effort happened, too. That's unique, right? To have a campaign that quick.
It's pretty surprising. It usually takes quite a long time to do these, and especially because, you know, the process at this point, there's sort of a well-oiled union-busting industry out there that, you know, one of its number one tactics is delay until you can, you know, through attrition or through firing, you know, pro-union employees, have some turnover in the workplace, delay so people get frustrated, delay so you have time to like make some promises and maybe, you know, give some selective raises or bonuses. Like, the fact that they've gotten to this point really quickly says they organized even quicker because, you know, they have the votes are due by March 29th. So it's taken them basically a year from, you know, starting work basically to their union vote being completed, which is, yeah, it's really fast.
And that's about what you think. I mean, you point to that it's been unique times. We all have clarity around how challenging it is to work. But what else would you associate? Like, what is different that has made that happen?
Yeah, I mean, there are so many answers to that question, right? Like, there have been some really high profile union drives in the South in recent years, including in Alabama, around mostly automobile plants. But the workers in this union have cited the organizing that was going on at other Amazon facilities. Notably, you know, they reached out to RWDSU, the Retail, Wholesale, and Department Store Union, because they had heard of them organizing Amazon workers on Staten Island. Mm-hmm. And they had walkouts at that Staten Island facility earlier. Well, yeah, about a year ago. So, you know, they came into that having seen other Amazon workers' militancy and also being, you know, surrounded perhaps by those stories. And also, you know, I'm obsessed with this particular history because one of my favorite works of labor and social movement history is Robin D.G. Kelly's Hammer and Hoe, which just happens to take place in that part of Alabama. Mm-hmm. And it's a story of Black workers in the Communist Party in Alabama in the New Deal era. And, you know, Bessemer is one of the parts of the state that he's writing about in that. And so it's really, you know, you have to sort of remember that, like, some of these workers' grandparents might have been in some of these unions that were backed by, you know, the Communist Party back in those days, where right. You had real radical Black organizing happening in this area. And so, you know, there are so many layers to this.
We forget about that history, right? That there is, it's so easy to think about the South in particular as this fully controlled area, particularly mm-hmm. when it comes to workers and the absence of radical politics. And there's this rich, rich history of Black radicalism there.
Right. And that radicalism is what, you know, going back all the way to slave revolts and then Reconstruction and then, you know, this kind of organizing that was going on during the Jim Crow era and then, you know, Alabama. Once again, it is, we're talking on the anniversary of Bloody Sunday, I believe.
Yes, we are.
Right.
Yes,
we are, you know, looking through this history of, you know, the Black freedom struggle. And I, you know, the way that these workers have talked about this, the way that other workers in the area who are supporting them have talked about this, it's very, very clear that they understand this as a struggle, not just for, you know, workplace justice, but for racial justice. And to say, like, we are as, you know, deserving of fair treatment and good treatment in the workplace as anything.
That too, though, is a new idea, a new modern idea in the labor movement, right? I mean, the labor movement has not been associated with racial justice for most of its time. And now here we are tonight, the president, you, those workers, we're all talking about this as a racial justice thing. How did that come to be? When you have chronicled that shift in your work.
Yeah.
Can you break that down?
Well, and again, you know, there is a history of this being a contested topic within the labor movement, right? So like unions like the Mine Mill Workers Union, the International Union of Mine, Mill, and Smelter Workers is the actual full name. They were multiracial unions even back before the Wagner Act, before, you know, the National Labor Relations Act is what that really is. Sorry. Mm-hmm. And there were fights about this within the labor movement. Again, that like there were radical organizers for a very long time who said we have to actually include race in our argument. And like the history of the reasons that the South is not as unionized as the rest of the country, the reason that right to work laws spread across the South was that, you know, anti-union campaigns took advantage of racism and split workforces along race lines. And this was done very intentionally, right? And so the labor movement, at least the people within the labor movement who realized this was a problem, realized it because they were losing, right? The Operation Dixie, which was the campaign to organize, to unionize the South, fell apart because they never really figured out how to talk about racism. And, you know, we still see this as a problem. But there is also this history that that does include things like the Atlanta washerwomen's strike, right, where you have Black women laundry workers going on strike and refusing to do laundry back, you know, before 1900. You have a history of, I was just looking at my notes from the book Detroit, I Do Mind Dying, which is about the Dodge Revolutionary Union movement, which was Black workers in Detroit in the 60s and 70s, organizing against things like automation on the factory floor. And noting that the machines were always sort of introduced in the part of the factory where there were Black workers, because they would be the ones whose bodies would be sort of sacrificed to testing out the new machines. Mm.
Well, I mean, speaking of machines and testing them out, I mean, this is one of the things that is core in the Amazon debate, is sort of what happens in these factories with the technology. One of the things, as you said, they're talking about sort of the productivity models and the things that are used to drive productivity. Can you describe the time on task productivity tool that people talk about? This is the thing that, you know, just remind listeners, the whole point here is that the core business model is to get products to us fast and cheap. And in order to do that, they crank up productivity inside these warehouses. And so can you describe this productivity, this time on task tool?
Yeah. So I was talking to an Amazon worker from Minnesota, one of the workers who organizes with the Awood Center outside of Minneapolis. And he was describing it as like getting into debt. So you're working and you are, you know, picking items off the line and putting them into boxes, and your time on that is being tracked. Every item that you scan is being tracked. And so you get your time up to whatever point. This is always about time, isn't it, Kai? Mm-hmm. You get your time up to a good level, a good rate, but then you have to go to the bathroom. And then you have to walk halfway across the warehouse to go to the bathroom. And then maybe there's somebody in the bathroom when you get there. So you have to wait for them to be done. By the time you get back, you've been off task for 30 minutes and your time has gone way down. And so you have to, as he's saying, sort of work your way out of this debt, because if you don't, you get written up. And if you get written up too many times, you lose your job. So, you know, he kept saying to me, like, that the system is not designed for human bodies, because like human bodies do things like have to pee.
Like go to the bathroom.
Right. You know?
Well, coming up, we're going to turn to some of the deeper ideas Sarah Jaffe gets to in her new book, Work Won't Love You Back. How does our overall culture and our feelings about work and productivity isolate us from one another and set us up for exploitation? We will discuss and we will take your calls. I want to hear about your own experiences with collective action in the workplace. If you or someone in your family have worked in an Amazon warehouse, I'm particularly interested in hearing about your experience. But everybody, what's your personal experience with trying to act collectively with your coworkers, either through a union or otherwise? This is the United States of Anxiety. I'm Kai Wright. We'll be right back. Do you ever feel like there's nothing new in the news? You know, like there are urgent things happening in the world, but all you hear is noise. That's where What Next comes in, a daily news show we love from Slate. They tell you the stories you haven't heard before, or a different side to the stories you thought you already knew. Join host Mary Harris every day as she cuts through the noise so that together we can all figure out what next. Follow and listen wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome back. This is the United States of Anxiety. I'm Kai Wright, and this week we are talking about collective action. And I want to start with a caller Sarah introduced us to. Tyler Hamilton is a worker and organizer at one of Amazon's large warehouses in Minnesota. Tyler, are you there? Thanks for calling in.
Yep, Tyler here.
So first off, I gather you're 24 years old and have worked at the warehouse for 4 years now, so since you were 20. And you've held all the jobs in that course of our time to get us our packages in our 2 days' time. So I wonder if you can just kind of quickly talk us through what that looks like for a worker to get us these packages so quickly. What were each of your jobs? Like, what did you do on each of those?
Well, I've done everything except for packing.
Okay.
But everything you buy online, when you can get that two-day shipping, like it's physically there in the warehouse. That's why they're so huge. So there's a large inventory area that people work around in workstations. Sort of the first spot in that line is people who stock the inventory. That's the stow department. I was there for a year and a half. When you actually buy something, then it has to be picked out of that inventory. So that is what the pick department does. Mm-hmm. I was in pick for a year. After you pick it, it goes down a conveyor belt somewhere, off to get packed and sorted. Once it's packed into boxes, they go onto trucks and they get sent out to be delivered to you.
And what in doing all of that, like, what do you think consumers and listeners need to know about that work?
I mean, a lot of the work, it does come at a cost. Your Prime membership, it pays for a good chunk of things, but the way a lot of things run, when Amazon tries to increase their bottom line, it usually comes at workers' expense. Mm-hmm. Because workers just fundamentally don't have a say in that decision-making process.
And you guys have, in Minnesota, at your warehouse, you have nonetheless tried to have a say. Can you talk about that a little bit? You don't have a union, you haven't been unionized, but you have found other ways to work collectively. So what does that look like?
A lot of people don't realize that you and your workers, if you work collectively in your workplace, it doesn't have to be over, you know, unionization specifically. It can be smaller things, but bigger things. But working collectively, you can have a big impact. There have been all sorts of situations. Maybe a coworker gets fired for a really dumb reason. And we have had walkouts that have happened for reasons like that, where we've gotten people their jobs back. Mm. It could be a smaller thing. You know, a small change in your working conditions that, you know, your supervisors or someone higher up in corporate made. And you don't always win. You don't always make things better. But if you don't try, you can't. At least if you make that effort, you have some chance of fixing things or making things better.
How do you, before I let you go, Tyler, how do you feel about your time? That's what Sarah and I keep returning to, this idea of time. how do you feel about your own ownership of your personal time in relationship to all this work?
I mean, that's one of the most important things. Everyone in the warehouse, we talk about it almost compulsively. It's your time on task, your time off task. What is your time off? Do you have time off? Wow. How much do you have left? If you run out of time off at Amazon, you get fired.
Wow.
And they automatically deduct your time off if you walk out, you strike, you know, you punch out. So that's also an issue.
Well, Tyler, thank you for calling in and offering us that testimony.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Let's go to Frank in Princeton, New Jersey. Frank, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm actually in Princeton Junction, but it's close to Princeton.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Yeah, I work at City University of New York at Baruch College. I'm an English professor. And the union there, which is called the Professional Staff Congress, has about 30,000 members at CUNY, mostly, you know, professors and adjunct instructors and also some staff, higher education employees. And we're constantly engaged in a kind of battle with the administration and with the state of New York as well about funding. We're suffering, you know, a kind of atmosphere of continuous austerity. I make about maybe 60% of what people make at other colleges in comparable positions. And we're relying more and more on part-time instructors, adjuncts, who are paid just terrible wages. I mean, not bad for adjuncts, but still not really living wages. Anyhow, so the problem is that we as a union have been denied a very important tool that many unions can use. That is to say, we cannot go on strike. There's a law in New York State called the Taylor Law, which prohibits public service employees, teachers, policemen, garbage collectors, firemen. We are not allowed to go on strike. And if we do go on strike or have any kind of action like a job slowdown or what have you, we are fined 2 days' pay for every day we do that. And then the union is fined enormously, and union leaders are put in jail. So what I would like to know is, does the public know about this law, the Taylor Law? And it's not actually unique to New York. There are many states that have similar laws. But it's a terribly draconian measure. And can we do anything to get rid of it? Can we give unions some power again?
Sarah, quickly, can you answer that question before we get to some more callers, just about what exists to prevent people from being in unions?
Oh, my God, yeah. I mean, the thing about labor law in the U.S. is there's federal laws like the National Labor Relations Act that I mentioned before that give you things like broadly your right to take concerted activity is what they call it, which is collective action on the job, is protected by federal law. But there are things like the Taylor Law, right, that your caller was just saying, that do put severe restrictions on workers' right to organize in a lot of places. And, well, I mean, I've got Andrew Cuomo on the brain because he's all over the news lately, but this notably came up in the last governor's race in New York, right, because Cynthia Nixon, who is challenging Andrew Cuomo in the Democratic primary, she said she wanted to repeal the Taylor Laws because she said, like, employees like your caller should have the right to strike like private sector workers do. And yeah, so this is, it's one of the reasons that being a labor journalist in this country is so stressful, is I've got to remember a patchwork of local laws all over the place. But yeah, it's really striking.
Let's go to Gina in Brooklyn. Gina, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Yeah, so I was working at an Amazon facility, a Whole Foods here in Brooklyn, last year in the height of the pandemic, and just walked into my kitchen, heard your show, and had to call in because collective action is definitely something that I knew there was a need for in the space, but it felt impossible to happen. There were instances literally in the middle of March, April last year, where implementing masks came a bit later. We had one guy who wore his mask into work, and they took actions against him to reprimand him for that, because at that time, wearing masks was not implemented at the time. Like, that wasn't required yet. And so just in passing, people with my little shopping cart, I'd be like, oh my God, did you hear that happen? But nothing came out of it. Like, everybody was concerned, but the conversations, that group dynamic that needed to be there, just could not be facilitated, because I think of two main things. One, downtime is just not a thing. You don't have time to sit and congregate and talk because you're on the clock. You have to be packing things off the shelves, like, continuously. You don't have the few breaks that you have, you need to take, because you will collapse being on your feet for just 6 hours straight. So the downtime not being a thing is one, but also two, the way that they do scheduling really prohibits like, group congregating, because they drop shifts every day. Your schedule could literally change from day to day. So there's no guarantee that you're seeing the same person in a given week. So I just thought that those two things definitely were barriers to the kind of collective action that you're talking about.
Thank you so much for that testimony, Gina. Sarah, this is something we hear about a lot, is just the way that the workforce has, the workplace has changed to prevent us from getting together. In your book, you're also sort of chronicling these ideas that have shifted, and I want to talk about that for a second. You write in the conclusion, the promises made to a generation of hope laborers are being revealed for the lies they are. What do you mean by this?
I mean, on that level, it's the basic idea that if we work really hard, again, like your caller who's a college professor, right? If you work really hard and you work your way up, you will get to this job where you have stability and you have a decent paycheck and you have respect. Except what actually happens, like your caller said, is that more and more people who are getting PhDs in this country are just doing part-time adjunct work. And that's one of the ways, like each of your three callers there were talking about time, right, in such interesting ways, because part-timing of what were full-time jobs is one of the ways that this has really been destroyed, right? So now, whether you're a college professor or you're working at Whole Foods, each boss is using sort of this hyper-segmented control over people's time in order to disempower the workforce in different ways. So whether that's adjunct professors who get paid by the class and they don't get paid for any of the other things that go along with being a college professor, like doing your research, presenting at conferences, publishing in academic journals, which don't pay you, all of those things are denied them, right? Or if you're at Whole Foods, this, you know, sort of high-tech scheduling software that is used in so many of these retail outlets these days is designed to sort of slice and dice scheduling down by the minute, and yet also seems to mysteriously always be really good at punishing workers who do anything like speak out on the job by cutting their hours. So the way that control over time has been used to sort of continually just make work worse is my recurring theme here, isn't it?
Well, and another recurring thing, we've got like a couple of minutes left here. Just, you seem really concerned with the way it has made our internal lives worse as well, that we are isolated from each other in a unique kind of way.
Yeah, the way, I mean, the subtitle is sort of cheeky, but it is true that I think that when we're encouraged to sort of devote all of our emotional attention to the job, what are we not spending that time on? What are we not spending that sort of affection on? And also, right, like as we're talking about this in the context of collective action, like it's literally, you know, the job is increasingly designed to keep us separate from each other so that we don't organize and make trouble. But on so many levels, right, we need other people. Like I'm so aware of this right now because it's, you know, we're not in full lockdown here in New York right now, but I'm still living alone during a pandemic. And it's pretty depressing. So I'm like, I'm hyper aware of this now, that the separation of people from each other, which has a lot to do with work, but it's not exclusively due to work, is really painful and stressful.
Sarah Jaffe is author of the new book, Work Won't Love You Back, How Devotion to Our Jobs Keeps Us Exploited, Exhausted, and Alone, out now from Bold Type Books. Sarah, thanks.
Thank you.
I'm Kai Wright. This is the United States of Anxiety. We'll be right back with more conversation about collectivity. Everybody, a quick program note. We're going to continue thinking about collective action in our next episode, but in the context of the pandemic, and I want to ask for your help in advance of that episode. So we're thinking about how communities of people have been banding together in new ways out of need throughout the past year through emergency care networks and food banks and any number of things that fall under this newly popularized term, mutual aid. So what is that? What is mutual aid? What's its history? And how have we all used forms of it, whatever we called it? That's what we're going to talk about. And we want to hear from you in advance about your own experiences with it. We're going to take your calls throughout the episode, but send me a voicemail now and let me know, have you joined any kind of collective effort to take care of each other in your community over the past year? Record a voice memo on your phone and email it to anxiety@wnyc.org. Again, that's anxiety@wnyc.org. And I want to know why you joined the effort and what you got out of it or what you didn't get out of it. So again, send your voicemail to anxiety@wnyc.org and we'll pull them together and use them in next week's show. Thanks so much. Welcome back. This is the United States of Anxiety. I am Kai Wright. Thanks to everybody who called in our last segment. Sorry to those we didn't get to. You can always email me your thoughts, anxiety@wnyc.org. But now I'm going to turn to another topic on collectivity. At some point deep into the darkness of 2020, one of our reporters, Jenny Casas, started talking about a novel by Octavia Butler. It's called Parable of the Sower, and it's one of those classic texts that a lot of people found or rediscovered during the course of the pandemic because it feels disturbingly relevant. Jenny read Parable of the Sower and we started talking about the book, and I'm just going to let the conversation we had speak for itself. Here's Jenny.
So just to like refresh, it was written in 1993 and it starts in 2024. So really close to where we are right now.
This is a really, really bad time to read that book.
or the best time to read this book. I don't know. I guess it depends on how much you desire to sleep well at night or how much you want to sit at peace in your heart. But Octavia Butler like paints this dystopian future. Yeah.
The society that I portray is pretty much broken.
And Octavia Butler described her thinking behind this dystopian future in interviews she gave when she was still alive.
The people who are surviving with any decency at all are living in walled communities and risking their lives whenever they go out. There are a lot of reasons for this. Drugs, of course.
And growing wealth inequality.
Deterioration of public education.
And capitalism and climate change disaster and like shortages of resources like water.
Global warming is practically a character in Parable of the Sower.
There's a lot of like desperation and violence. People are just like, they need to survive, so they will do whatever they need to make sure that that happens. And that can involve burning down your house or stealing all of your stuff or killing you or violating you. Like, I mean, I'm sure when you read it, you felt this way too, but it's just kind of like,
yeah,
it's horrifying because you're like, I know that this can happen.
Their problems now, they become disasters because they're not attended to.
It's too real. It's a fantasy of a dystopia that feels quite real. And I read it before all of these things started happening. Because isn't there also like there's a sort of Christian right, narcissist, wildly destructive, hate-spewing president that led to all this too? Isn't that one of the characters?
Yep. Well, so the central character is this young woman named Lauren Olamina, who in the chaos of this moment is bringing together various skills and preparing essentially for the collapse of her community and in a world where it feels like one must be out for themselves because things are so desperate. Our main character is so unique in that she is actively trying to not do that, right? She's trying to move collectively and work collectively.
She is a person who has a mission. She has a religion that she feels that she has discovered as opposed to created, and that she feels would make humanity a little bit more survivable if they paid attention to it.
I mean, it's one of those books that over 2020 people did start talking about, right? Like a lot of people picked Octavia Butler back up, you know, Handmaid's Tale was another one. Some of these books that seem to have predicted the future in which we live. And then, you know, I'm joking that I would have found it stressful to read right now, but a lot of people also were looking to it for inspiration and understanding as a way to just understand the moment we're in.
Right. And one of those people is one of my favorite authors, Adrienne Marie Brown, who's an activist and a speaker and a doula and a facilitator and also a scholar of Octavia Butler's work. And she and the legendary musician
Toshi Regan
launched a podcast this last year.
We are the co-hosts of Octavia's Parables, a chapter-by-chapter reading of Octavia Butler's Parable of the Sower.
And they talk about what this story means for us right now.
If we can't turn and face this story, then we can't turn and face our own reality and find the opportunity to move out of this kind of reality to something else.
So, okay, Kai, when you read the book, do you remember a character named Keith?
He's Lauren's brother, right?
Yes, exactly. And Keith is a foil for our main character.
What are some of the things that Keith has done?
Keith kills an elder. He thinks the elder is absurd. He sees him as vulnerable. He kind of befriends him enough to get close to him and figure out what he has and where he thinks he's going. And then he kills him and takes his stuff.
All of his actions underscore this point that when we are out for ourselves, we are actually only marching towards our own demise.
Mm-hmm. You're in this world that's falling apart, and it's kind of Lauren and Keith are both seeing the disaster hit, and they react in very different ways. He has this idea that, like, strength will save us, you know, that might will save us, and if I can be mighty, that's what's going to help. And it turns out to be dramatically wrong. It's exactly the wrong thing.
Yeah. It ends up getting him killed.
I know that we can be better human beings than that, but it's so tempting to be greedy and have power and keep it from other people.
And thinking about, like, there's so many examples, but the pandemic is the most clear and obvious one to me, where it's like, you actually can do tremendous amounts of damage and never see the consequences of it.
Right. Because it's also that it's very easy to be Keith. It's very easy to think, oh, I can take care of me. You know, like, yeah, I don't know. I can't solve this whole pandemic business. I can't do anything about COVID, but I can live my particular kind of life and the way I want to do it. And it won't affect anybody else. It'll just be me. So I can make choices about like when I do and don't wear masks and where I travel and all of that. And it's just my own choice. I feel like it's easier to make selfish choices, oddly, at a moment when collective choices are so important.
Yeah, I think the biggest reflection that I leave from the book is that we have to be willing to work collectively or we will not make it. It's just been sitting really heavy on me because I think I feel pretty hopeless about our collective ability to do that now because we can't agree on it. Like, it just feels like in this country specifically, we can't agree on anything. And that's why I love to turn to Adrienne's work, because if you read her books, they are able to hold the nuance of both looking directly at the bleakness of what we've created, right? The inequities, the injustice of this world that we are all responsible for. But not only that, but there's possibility in the future. So like, if we can build this crummy situation, we can also build something that serves people thoughtfully and like with care, and it can be different. Like, it doesn't have to be like this. Plus she's a Virgo like me, so you know, but in general it's just constantly calling us to consider where we sit in the collective.
And so you went to talk to Adrienne about this.
Yeah, I got to bring it to Adrienne and ask her about what to do with all these hopeless feelings.
As I was preparing for this conversation, I was really trying to pinpoint, where is my hopelessness? Where is that?
Like, where is it in you?
I mean, I think it was, or the best way that I was finding words to describe it was like a hopelessness in our collective desire to care for each other, right? And then I was also like, but I have a tremendous community of people that I love and respect who like care for me. So how is it that I can be so hopeless?
I mean, that's so, I feel you on that, right? I think that's the tension of interdependence, right? Is that even if I only want to pay attention to those who love me and treat me well, I'm also in an interdependent species. And so I cannot deny or disconnect myself fully from those who hate me, from those who refuse to wear masks, from those who refuse to listen to science, from those who refuse to, you know, turn and get in right relationship with the earth. Sometimes I think it would be a dream world if I could just be like, okay, like, I don't have to mess with you or think about you ever again. That'd be so great. Unfortunately, we're interconnected. And so all of that is also my responsibility, because I've been saying this a lot, that we're not responsible for convincing anyone to love us, but we are responsible for saving what we love. And I think time will tell. I mean, if you were writing science fiction, this year couldn't be written better as a year, right? It's like, here along comes something that in order to survive it, we have to learn how to be in relationship with each other in an accountable way. And we will not make it if we don't turn towards each other in that way.
You mentioned like, oh, there's a lot of Keiths in the world right now, right? There's a lot of people.
Yes.
And I felt myself wanting to like be in that conversation and just be like, so what do we do? Like, what can I do with, you're right. Like, we can't cut
out. Don't just ignore. Right. I think there's a lot of lessons. I think one that is always really important to me is to humble myself to the fact that I can't save anyone who doesn't want to be saved. And I can't heal anyone who doesn't want to be healed. And I can't control anyone who doesn't want to be controlled. And even those who do want to be controlled, you just can't really control other people. I've tried, you know, like, because being a Virgo means you do think like, I've got better solutions. I've got a great way forward all the time. But it doesn't matter, because fundamentally, each person on this planet is a sovereign entity, right? They are moving of their own accord and recognizance and with their own internal realm that is determining that. And so I think with someone like a Keith character, sometimes it's just the practice of modeling what it looks like, that you can take accountability, that you can actually change, that you can admit you were wrong and you'll survive, you know? And I'm trying to be that kind of human, is someone who can be like, I'm not perfect, actually. I make mistakes and I'm going to keep learning. And there's people who know me deeply and love me and are invested in my growth. And they fortify me to live in a world of Keiths. And, you know, what happens in the book, which I always say, I don't think you can spoil Octavia, so this may be a spoiler, but what happens in the book is like, Keith meets his own demise because of the decisions he makes. And I think a lot of us have people in our lives who are like getting sick, dying. You know, some of those people tried to be safe the whole time and others didn't, right? And I'm angry with them and I'm grieving for them. And like, I'm grieving about the systems that created the conditions in which, you know, this shouldn't have been something that was individual by individually decided, right? The places that have had the best response to COVID are the places where there have been mandates at a national level about, you know, what the boundaries were going to be, so that it just wasn't left up to people. Now we have to sit with what happens when someone makes a choice and the consequence comes and you're next to them or you're grieving them, right? This is part of our human condition, is learning how we be in that emotional state.
And how we choose to show up to it, right? Like my flavor mm-hmm. of Virgo work that I need to do is like not being like, I told you so.
I told you so. You know, one of the things I feel like I have learned the hard way is I told you so. No one ever wants to hear that. And it doesn't add anything to the conversation. And it doesn't add anything to your spirit. So in moments where I'm like, I think I know better than you about your life, you know, what I actually am often thinking is I want to protect you from a lesson because I had to learn it and it sucks to learn this lesson. And you can skip it, right? But it doesn't actually work that way. Like for whatever reason, we are wired such that we like to learn through experience. We can read a billion books about it, you know, and I have so many people like, I've read everything about love. And I'm like, yes, but learning to love takes loving. It matters that you chose and you experienced, and now you have to reflect and you have to learn, and then you have to figure out what your next choice is going to be. And it really helps for me to have something I come back to every day that reminds me that most of what I feel and experience during the day will be a result of the choices I make. So there's all the external conditions. There's the things that are beyond what I can shape, the things I can shape, the things that only I can shape. And really being able to feel in that line, a lot of my energy I'm going to spend on the things only I can shape. What can I do? What can I be? How can I be in relationship with others? How can I love? How can I care? I try to spend very little attention on the things I don't feel like I can shape. There's so many ways that we could be, and we take it for granted that the way we are now is the way. This is a way. People were a different way 1,000 years ago, and they will be a different way 1,000 years from now. Hopefully we're still here. Everything else is up to us.
Right. Yeah. It's like the caveat is a terrifying one, but also so real.
I mean, kind of. I will also say this gives me like peace is like dinosaurs were amazing and then they were gone. And that doesn't mean they were any less amazing because they didn't last, you know, they weren't, you know, as far as we know, they didn't leave for any reason of their own, you know, activity, right? They just were like munching on something and then asteroids. So, you know, we are in a position where it may be sad. We may make ourselves extinct, but, you know, Octavia said our fundamental flaw is intelligence and hierarchy paired together, that we can't seem to use our intelligence for anything other than supremacy over each other. And I'm like, okay, so maybe that is our flaw. Maybe we don't survive it. But we still are absolutely incredible, absolutely miraculous. There's still so much beauty. There's so much pleasure. There's so much art. There's so much being created all the time. Children are still freaking awesome. Like, there's just so much that is still absolutely a worthwhile endeavor about our species. And so I'm like, it doesn't have to be forever to be amazing. You know, like, we could be another dinosaur kind of species that maybe we go, and then something else even more dynamic and incredible comes after us and looks at our bones and wonders about us and drives cars with our fossils. Who knows, right? Like, I don't know. Just to me, I'm just like, if we stop being overly attached to like our right to be the dominant species on Earth, I think we can find some peace in the experiment of it all.
Yeah, I'm like, dang, I didn't realize it went that deep. And now I'm like, yeah, of course it does.
It does, right? It does. And then on the other side of grief, there's room, right, to recognize, like, I feel hopeless because I love this place and I want to protect it. I feel grief because I feel deep gratitude for the connections that I got to have, and I want more of those people. And it makes me turn to the people who are still here. And I'm going to be greedy about the way I love all of them, right? I just like, I want to spend time with you and talk with you. And I don't want to take for granted what we have. Like, I know how precious it is. Gratitude, 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 right? It's like, it's all precious, and you will grieve it when it's gone. So you better live into it and love into it now.
I'm going to carry that into my week. I'm Kai Wright. This is the United States of Anxiety. Thanks for spending this time with us. United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. Joe Plord mixed the podcast version. Kevin Bristow and Matthew Miranda were at the boards for the live show. Our team also includes Carolyn Adams, Emily Botine, Ginny Casas, Karen Frillman, and Christopher Wirth. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Vera Lynn Williams is our executive producer, and I am Kai Wright. You can keep in touch with me on Twitter at Kai_Wright. And as always, I hope you will join us for the live version of our show next Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern. You can stream it at WNYC.org or tell your smart speaker to play WNYC. Until then, thanks for listening and take care of yourselves.